Hey, podcast listeners, it's Brandon Hollingsworth, host of The Method. Thank you so much for listening to our science program. You can, of course, always check it out online at WUOT.org. Now, I'm going to get out of the way because this is a webcast extra in which you'll be able to listen to a special, longer version of my conversation with author Margaret Lazarus Dean. We talk a lot more about the space program, the glory days of Apollo, and how quickly that glory evaporated, and the utilitarian nature of the shuttle, and so much more. We're going to start by hearing Margaret Lazarus Dean as she responds to a question I asked about maybe why the space program lost its luster so quickly after the Apollo missions.
Yeah, I think that idea that we sort of lost faith in the technology is definitely reflected in a lot of the research that I did. I think there was a feeling in the early 1960s when it became clear that we could go to the moon if we wanted to, people found that idea very energizing. And there was a lot of offshoots to that. You know, well, we can declare we're going to cure cancer within 10 years. We can declare we're going to end poverty within 10 years. But as time went on, it became clear, I think, that there are certain kinds of problems that technology can solve, and going to the moon is luckily one of them, but that a lot of bigger, more complex problems, including curing cancer, actually, which has as much to do with public health and the choices that people make as it does with medicine, a lot of those problems can't be cured so easily with technology. And so I think it's true that there was a change in belief about what technology could do for society or what technology could do for people as individuals. And then maybe we've dropped off too far in the other direction. I think there's right now a real mistrust of technology. As much as we surround ourselves with it, we also are always telling ourselves that it's bad for us, that we shouldn't be using our phones so much, that we shouldn't be so glued to our screens. I think we've almost come to an opposite belief that technology will be our downfall. But again, there isn't real clear evidence that that's the case either.
I'm really glad that in your book you mentioned that NASA's funding was already being trimmed back even before Apollo 11, before Neil and Buzz and the Sea of Tranquility. I think starting in fiscal year 1965 is when we started to see NASA's budget peak and then start coming back down. Not many people know that the political steam was already running out of the effort behind the space program even before its primary goal was met. Do you think that a lot of the political and societal reactions to the space program was in part because it happened so quickly that we went from never having been in space in 1957 to the moon in 1969, and that maybe it's just hard for people to comprehend what all that meant, and so it was hard to sort of contextualize it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of different ways to interpret that. I know that when I tell people about this, that the funding had already dropped off by 1966, they're always surprised to learn that. I think there's a kind of backward-looking mythology making about Apollo, that everyone was behind it, everyone was excited about it, everyone wanted to spend the money. And that really wasn't the case. Public opinion was fairly divided, even throughout the 1960s, about whether we should be going to the moon at all, about whether it was appropriate to spend the kinds of money that we were spending. So I think we have to be careful about, you know, making assumptions about public opinion in the 1960s. At the same time, I think it's disappointing to a lot of people to realize the original impetus to do this, you know, when John F. Kennedy made his speech to Congress and said, we should set this goal, we should dedicate ourselves to going to the moon, that for a lot of people, the motivation behind going along with that idea really just came out of the Cold War. We didn't want the Soviets to control the moon. As silly as that sounds, there was an idea if the Soviets could get to the moon first, they would make it a military base and they could send bombs to the United States from the moon, which actually, if you ask physicists, was not really something to stay up at night worrying about. But I think for a lot of Americans, that was a motivation for supporting that project. And once we did it, once we beat the Soviets to the moon, a lot of those people felt like, well, we did it, let's stop spending the money. Whereas space fans felt like we were just getting going. And those space fans are still disappointed, still feel like we were just getting going in 1969.
That actually brings me to my next point, because I brought with me this lovely encyclopedia yearbook from 1970 here in the studio with us. It's a fantastic little thing, and in the back of it, in the space section, there's a chart showing NASA's plans for advanced explorations, including space stations and bases on the moon, manned Mars landing by 1981. This is not Heinlein, it's not Bradbury. This is what NASA was planning for the 1970s and the 1980s. And of course, that never really materialized. Do you feel your generation and mine and subsequent generations were were cheated, or is that the right way to describe it?
I mean, I'd like to think that our best days in spaceflight are still ahead of us. You know, I like to think that I will see, or maybe my son will get to see, Americans set foot on Mars. And if that should happen, then I certainly won't feel cheated that I didn't get to see the moon landings in 1969. But I think there is a feeling among people my parents' generation, or maybe even my grandparents' generation, that landing on the moon was the pinnacle, was as good as it's going to get. And that people who didn't get to take part in that, and especially for going forward, the idea that space projects that don't sort of emulate that Apollo model have missed the boat, and that, you know, the rest of us only just have to learn about it in history books. I'm sort of energized by young people I know who are interested in solving problems of getting to Mars, are interested in different kinds of new spaceflight projects, and they think Apollo is great, but that was a long time ago, and that was using old technology. So we should be talking about what are we going to do next, and how are we going to solve the problems of getting there safely.
Well, the manner of spaceflight that followed Apollo, of course, was the shuttle. And in this very same Encyclopedia yearbook from 1970, there's an artist's rendering here of what they thought the shuttle might look like. And it looks like a commercial freighter-type airplane that we'd be familiar with today. And so many commentators have written that the shuttle failed to ignite the public's imagination because it seemed so ordinary, that there was no poetry about it, you know. But even from its earliest conceptions, in the late 1960s and early 70s, it was never meant to be poetic. It was supposed to be boring, if I may use that word. It was supposed to be utilitarian. It was supposed to be an everyday sort of workhorse. So, I mean, I wonder, was it ever intended to capture the public's imagination?
Well, I think as NASA first intended, and this is probably laid out in the long-range plans that you have in that encyclopedia, it was NASA's intention to use a shuttle to build an orbiting space station. An orbiting space station is the best place to build a large interplanetary spacecraft, and then to use that spacecraft to get to Mars. They had this whole plan laid out, and the shuttle was only just the first piece of this large, ambitious plan. And Congress and budgetary constraints being what they are, NASA got bargained down to just the shuttle eventually. So, I think in a lot of ways it's unfair to blame the shuttle for being boring when it did what it was asked to do. It went into space over and over again. It took a lot of cargo to space. It took a lot of human beings to space. More than 300 people have gone to space on the space shuttle. But at the same time, I think it's still a beautiful spacecraft. And I think the things that it did were awe-inspiring and were worthy of poetry. I know a lot of people who worked on the space shuttle all their lives, and they use very poetic and emotional terms to describe the spacecraft that they worked on. So I think it's a little unfair to shuttle, and maybe honestly has to do with the name. The name is really boring compared to Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, you know, these names from Greek and Roman mythology.
Right, right.
I think the shuttle deserves a prettier name than shuttle, given what it did.
And actually, each of the orbiters had very nice names, and Challenger, Atlantic, Discovery, Endeavor. And so maybe some of the naming, the nomenclature of the individual shuttles might have helped with that. You also write that the space shuttle program itself never really recovered from the Challenger accident in 1986. Even though the shuttles kept flying, once the investigation was completed in 1988, the program resumed and, of course, got a new orbiter, Endeavour, in 1992. So why do you think Challenger was such a lasting blow to the program? It did survive. So tell me a little bit more about what you meant about how it never really recovered after Challenger.
Yeah, the program did survive. Challenger was the first real space disaster that we had to deal with. It's remarkable, if you think about it, that all of the Mercury flights flew safely. All of the Gemini flights flew safely. There was a fire in preparations for Apollo 1, which killed the crew. That was a blow.
But it happened on the ground.
It happened on the ground.
That was a test before the launch and not while in flight on television, you know.
Right, and the drive to get to the moon was still so strong at that point, I think it was easier to recover from that blow politically. NASA was able to put that behind them. But the space shuttle was sold to us as something that would be safe, that would be routine. That particular mission especially was the first mission on which a civilian was really advertised as flying, specifically because the shuttle was so safe, was not as physically taxing as the older spacecraft had been, so that really a normal citizen in good physical health could fly in the shuttle. They had chosen a school teacher to go on this particular mission, and that was the one that blew up. So it really captured the American imagination, I think, in a way that the previous disaster had not. People were really devastated to realize what we were doing was risky, and it was really a moment to stop and ask, is this worth the risk, and is it worth the money? Ultimately, we decided to continue flying the shuttle, which I think was a correct decision. But as part of that, the safety regulations became more stringent. That made things slower. That made things more expensive. So it was another challenge to the shuttle, basically, to keep doing what it was doing, but with much more safety regulations. And then, of course, after Columbia, the safety regulations became even more strict. And that's not necessarily incorrect. When you're flying human beings, you're flying people's mothers and fathers, safety really should be at the forefront. But without the funding to kind of fund those regulations, it provided that much more of a challenge.
And we should point out that the Columbia, which you just alluded to, was a shuttle that burned up upon reentry in the Earth's atmosphere in February of 2003. That was a result of damage that was missed when insulation fell off the external fuel tank and damaged a wing of the shuttle. In this book, Leaving Orbit, you give a lot of attention to Cape Canaveral, which, of course, is the place where all these missions began. And the buildings and the launch pads that are there seem to stand as a reminder of what NASA thought or anticipated its future in space would be. And, for example, a really good example, the big vehicle assembly building, which is huge. It's 30 feet shorter than the Washington Monument and much larger in terms of its aerial footprint. It was built to house up to 4 Saturn V boosters at a time and have these big, like, sort of garage doors through which the rockets 36 stories high could be moved. Because NASA thought, hey, we might be sending Apollo missions to the moon all the time. We'll need space for 4 of these massive boosters. But that never really materialized. As we were talking about, the funding began to run out, the political support, the public support very quickly began to wane. What is it like going there to the Kennedy Space Center and seeing these great structures that never really lived up to the ambitions that built them?
Yeah, most of the structures of the Kennedy Space Center were built very quickly in 1965 and 1966. And it is a bit like going into a time machine. Everything is from a very specific moment, and everything was designed with, as you say, this kind of ambitious, optimistic idea in mind. And so it's odd to be there. I mean, these buildings have accomplished so much over the past 50 years. So many spacecraft have been assembled in the vehicle assembly building, and so many astronauts have gone to space on those spacecraft. But at the same time, as you say, the program has never quite gotten to live up to what it could have been and what was planned for. So NASA has always been kind of caught in this double bind. You know, we ask them to dream for us. We put them in charge of dreaming our dreams as Americans. But then when it comes to actually paying for things, we tell them, well, why don't you just do about 1/10 of that? Or why don't you do just about 1/20 of that? And so this is kind of reflected in the buildings. The dreams, you know, from this moment when Congress was funding NASA very generously, these dreams are kind of enshrined in these buildings. But what NASA has been able to do with them has been less. And of course, what NASA is able to do right now is much less now that we've lost the shuttle.
Right. The U.S., in fact, is facing what could be a long drought in being able to launch people in manned spaceflight from Cape Canaveral. Now, I sort of am qualifying that because we can still launch astronauts, but we have to hitch a ride with the Russians, which launch from the Baikonur Cosmodrome out in Kazakhstan. We don't have anything going out of Cape Canaveral right now. And the successor to the space shuttle, the Orion capsules, Project Orion, are still several years away from even test flights with people. Is that a little discouraging to you?
It is. I mean, one thing worth mentioning is the project NASA's involved in right now to encourage private companies to take over what the shuttle used to do. So the two front runners right now are SpaceX and Boeing. They're both developing rockets and spacecraft that can take first cargo to the International Space Station. SpaceX has already accomplished that. But soon they're both expecting to be able to send astronauts to the International Space Station as well. And SpaceX at least does launch from Cape Canaveral. NASA has leased an old launch pad to them. And some of those buildings that NASA used to use, people have mixed feelings about that, whether a private company should be using NASA facilities, even if they're paying. But that's one way of looking at where we are in terms of spaceflight right now. I don't think the private companies are going to answer all of our hopes and dreams, because if you want to see a project like a Mars exploration project, or even landing on asteroids, the sort of things that astronomers want to do, the sort of things that little children dream of getting involved in, those are not projects that are great at returning money to shareholders, which ultimately the private companies have to be responsible to their shareholders. So I hope to see NASA continue to be a leader if the private companies taking over a low Earth orbit means that NASA gets to think more about Mars and pushing out further into space. I think that's fantastic, but that also means that we have to fund them. And as of right now, Congress is not especially committed to doing that.
As a child, you used to spend weekends at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., which I think is just marvelous. I've been there only a couple of times, but I love it. At the time that you're talking about this, when you were a young girl, it was about 1978, 79, and of course they had the Apollo 11 command module, the gumdrop-shaped capsule that we all remember from footage of the landings and whatnot, on display at the Air and Space Museum. And even just 10 years down the road after 1969, you write that you felt like it already felt antiquated, it already felt outdated. You couldn't even believe that people went to the moon in something that looked like this thing. I wanted to ask if you've seen any of the shuttles now that they've been retired and have joined the Apollo, Mercury, and Gemini capsules as historic pieces, museum relics.
It is interesting to think that the spacecraft that I personally got to see fly, I saw all three of them launch at one time or another, and I got to see Atlantis land. But to think that these spacecraft, which were taking to the skies and taking human beings to space not long ago, are now kind of joining the jumble of stuff in a museum. I was there when Discovery was put into the Air and Space Museum. There was sort of a dedication. And that was exciting to see. But when Discovery was rolled in, the wall closed behind it and sort of the crowd settled, the dust settled. And we could see that just in front of Discovery was also visible one of the Mercury capsules, which was space flown. And in a way, it was nice to see these things kind of taking up residence together. But as you say, at the same time, it's a little disturbing to think this is now just a relic, like this Mercury capsule, which will never go to space again. What are we replacing it with? What is the next thing going to be? And I think the technology does feel a little outdated. I think the space shuttles are beautiful because I love what they did. But when the closer you get, the more you can see these things were really manufactured in the 70s, you know, starting with the first ones. It's not new technology that was brought to bear for the most part.
That is interesting because, yeah, you're right. That was an issue, I think, early in the 2000s. There was a big overhaul to give the shuttles what they called glass cockpits, which would be more modern displays. And I think a lot of people would be surprised that in the 21st century, the shuttles were still using old cathode ray tubes, the big heavy tubes, and computer keyboards that really dated. And computer programs, too, memory programs from the 70s and early 80s. I think people might be surprised to learn that. And it also probably argues for why the shuttle system at least needed to be retired at some point. It had a 30-year run, which was longer than Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo combined. So we got a lot of use out of the shuttles.
That's right. They did have a 30-year run, but they were each designed to withstand at least 100 flights. And the most flown of them, Discovery, only had 39 flights. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a common idea that they were retired just because they were getting so old. I think that people who took care of them would tell you they still had good life left in them. They were getting older. They were getting clunkier, certainly not at the cutting edge of technology anymore. But we could have continued flying them safely.
Margaret Lazarus Dean is an associate professor in the Department of English here at the University of Tennessee. Her newest book is called Leaving Orbit. It's about the end of the space shuttle program and its cultural effects. Margaret, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.